Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Ruth, a Heaping Portion of Questionable Security, presented by Hans Dahl, session number DAH-2005-03. Let's listen in.
Awesome. God, we give thanks for this day, for the sun, for the stars, for the trees, and for life, new life that happens each day. Stir in us new life this day. Help us to come to know your wonderful, inclusive forgiveness in new ways this day. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, we've been digging through Ruth here, and today we're getting into this, maybe the more, I don't know how you'd say, racy part of Ruth. Things warm up a little bit here. But it's talking about security, and I really hope that we can get into some dialogue about what's going on here, because for us to read Ruth and try and bring some of that back to today, I think is very problematic at times. I think that can be a problematic thing. I think there's issues of women's roles in society that we need to be conscious of. So I hope that we can have some dialogue, and if something catches you as we go along the way, that you speak up. And I find that Bible study is always most fruitful when it's a conversation. And so I hope that you engage today in kind of some of the conversation. But when we were studying this in the congregation I was at, a woman gave me this email forward. You know, you get all kinds of email forwards. A boat docked in a tiny Mexican village. An American tourist complimented the Mexican fisherman on the quality of his fish and asked how long it took him to catch them. Not very long, answered the Mexican, but then, why didn't you stay out longer and catch more? Asked the American. The Mexican explained that his small catch was sufficient to meet his needs and those of his family. The American asked, but what do you do with the rest of your time? I sleep late, I fish a little, play with my children, and take a siesta with my wife. In the evenings, I go into the village to see my friends and have a few drinks, play the guitar, and sing a few songs. I have a full life. The American interrupted, well, I have an MBA from Harvard, and I can help you. You should start by fishing longer every day. You can then sell the extra fish you catch. With the extra revenue, you can buy a bigger boat. With the extra money the larger boat will bring, you can buy a second one and a third one, and so on until you have an entire fleet of trawlers. Instead of selling your fish to a middleman, you can negotiate directly with the processing plants and maybe even open your own plant. You can then leave this little village and move to Mexico City, Los Angeles, or even New York City. From there, you can direct your huge enterprise. Well, how long will that take? Asked the Mexican man. 20, perhaps 25 years, replied the American. And after that? Afterwards? That's when it gets really interesting, answered the American, laughing. When your business gets really big, you can start selling stocks and make millions. Millions, really? And after that? He asked. After that, you'll be able to retire, live in a tiny village, sleep late, play with your children, take a few fish, take a siesta with your wife, spend your evenings drinking and enjoying.
That is awesome.
Enjoy that little story. Enjoy that little story. Well, if you want to open your Bibles to Ruth here, and just to kind of recap kind of where we've come, where we've been, we start out Ruth 1, where we have this situation that Naomi and Ruth are in. They're left with no, They're left in a foreign land. They have no husbands. And so they're left without security, without food in a foreign land. They make their way to Bethlehem. And there, on that journey, Naomi says to Ruth and to Orpah, go back. Go back to your land where you can find security, where you can find a home and live a good life in familiar company. And Orpah says, okay, that's what I'm doing. I'm listening. I'm going to be obedient. But Ruth will not go. She goes above and beyond, and she clings, as we read, she clings to Naomi. And we have these beautiful words in the first chapter of her dedication, her commitment to going with this widowed woman back to the widowed woman's homeland in Bethlehem. But then we have Naomi's response, and it is silence. She doesn't know what to do. She says nothing. And so they head back to Bethlehem. And while in Bethlehem, it soon becomes Ruth who takes initiative in this story. And Naomi, in her experience of pain and her experience of what do I do now, becomes the passive one in this story. And so we're in chapter 2 is where we've made it to. And there we find a new character in the story. A character by the name of Boaz. And Boaz, there are some, just in his very name, there are some keys there. Boaz in the Hebrew means in him is strength. And so we're given these clues as to where the story is going, what role Boaz will play in this story. Keeping your finger in Ruth, turn to the Psalms, Psalm 104. I'm going to skip around a little bit today. Psalm 104. We talked about how at the beginning of this story there are two points of pain that are in that first paragraph, kind of sets up the context for the whole book. And the two points of pain are, where are we going to find our next meal? Where are we going to find the next meal, the food? And the second point of pain, which is still, we're trying to figure this out in the story, is how is this family going to continue? How is the family name going to continue? The sons are dead. The father, Elimelech, is dead. So how is the family name going to continue? But one of the things that I find kind of interesting is the way they would have viewed God at that time. And so if we look in Psalm 104, I'll just read a little bit here. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You have clothed with honor and majesty, wrapped in light as with a garment. You stretch out the heavens like a tent. You set the beams of your chambers on the waters. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers. Fire and flame your ministers. So there's this sense of God kind of controlling nature, or being the one who is within nature, the one controlling. If we move down to verse 14 here, verse 14 in my translation, it reads, "You cause the grass to grow for the cattle and plants for people to use, to bring forth food for the earth and wine to gladden the human heart. Oil to bring the to make the face shine, and bread to strengthen the human heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, and the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. In them the birds build their nests. The stork has its home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the conies." There's a sense that God is the one that provides. God is the one that provides for the sustenance of the earth. But also in verse 14, for the plants to grow, for the grass to grow, for the earth to bring forth the food. Go ahead.
What are Connie's?
I don't know.
Mine says rock badgers.
The rock badgers. Let's see, what does it say? My footnote says, the water and forest mountains are the homes of the wild animals.
Rock badger.
Yeah, mine says rock badger or hyrax.
Or hyrax.
Never heard of a hyrax.
Not either.
It's the hyraxyrus. Hyraxyrus, a small, hare-like, undulate mammal. So maybe something like a rabbit.
Okay. Maybe it's like a
squirrel or something.
Yeah.
Which is rabbits.
A rabbit? Yeah. Wild animals, you know, whatever the case may be. God is the one that provides refuge, but also the one that provides sustenance. And so you think about in the context of Ruth, God is the one that's providing that meal. God is the one, if you turn back to Ruth, verse 6. In some ways, throughout this story, Naomi tends to be a little schizophrenic. I gotta admit this. Because at the beginning of the story, so they're over in Moab, they found food, and now we see in verse 6, then she started to return with her daughters-in-law from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. The Lord was the one that provided food, and this was a wonderful thing. The Lord provides. Well, as we go on in the story, she begins to blame God for all these things that have gone wrong in her life. For all these things. And now she's having a change of heart, if we keep going to where we ended the last time we were together. And that was, let's start around verse 17.
Chapter 2.
So just to recap chapter 2, where we've gone so far. So Naomi ended up working out in the field, and she's out there gleaning. She's gathering the scraps that are left. And this was kind of the social service, the way of life, the way that those that were underprivileged or didn't have as they needed were to get their daily food. And so she's following behind, and it just so happened she came to the field of this guy, Boaz, who just so happened to be a relative of the family, a relative that they hadn't heard about. And so Ruth finds favor in this relative. The relative gives her special privileges, gives her special instructions as to how to stay close, to cling to the other women that were working in the field. And so if we move on to verse 17. Would somebody be willing to read from 17 on through 23?
Somebody be willing to read that?
Thank you, John.
So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I work with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "The man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers."
All right. Where did you end there? Verse
20. Finish 20.
Yeah, why don't you keep going all the way to 23? Yeah.
Then Ruth, the Moabitess, said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.' Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girls, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
It's interesting, I keep thinking about this idea of this being the kind of the social safety net for people in those days. You know, those that would otherwise fall through the cracks, this is the way that they were provided for, this is the way they got their daily food. But I can't help but think this is a very short-term solution to a long-term problem for this family, these two. A very short-term solution, this idea of gleaning, it basically kept them on the same level. You know, there wasn't really any way they were going to, in a sense, move up in society or change their place. It was a short-term solution to a long-term problem. So that's where they sit. And so we kind of have gotten to this spot where we see a little glimmer of hope now in the story. And we even have Naomi, in some ways, getting excited here. Something is changing. And so if you look at verse 21 is kind of where I wanted to dig in. Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay close, my servant, until they have finished all my harvest.'" This language of staying close, it's the same language that in the beginning of the story, Ruth says about her faithfulness to Naomi. If we turn back to chapter 1, verse 14, this is where the second time Naomi said, "Go back, go back, go back." And their response is that they wept aloud. Orpah kissed Naomi, but Ruth clung to her. This word clung is the same word, the root word in the Hebrew is the same word as we see here in verse 22 or 21 of chapter 2. And we see how this the author of this book has kind of woven these words in together, has created this just beautiful connection between the two. And so we've got in verse 21, "Then Ruth the Moabite said, 'He even said to me, cling by my servants.'" One of the issues in this story is all about security. And now we find that that Boaz, in some ways, is becoming the security. There's a clue here that he's becoming the security that this story has been looking for. And so it says, "Stay close by my servant until they have finished all my harvest." Naomi said to Ruth, my daughter, her daughter-in-law, "It is better, my daughter, that you go out with his servant or with his women. Otherwise, you might be bothered in another field." So she stayed close. And we have that word again. She clung to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. In verse 23 there, we have this sense that it's a period of time has gone by now. It's been quite a while. She stayed close, not just till the end of the barley harvest, but the wheat harvest as well. So some time has transpired here for her. And now we see how are they going to find this long-term solution to their short-term drought? So we go on to chapter 3. When I started this chapter 3 before, I should have brought the DVD, but I started with A Fiddler on the Roof, Matchmaker. We've got a little bit of matchmaking going on here. I think that's kind of cute. And so let's start there. Would someone be willing to read from verse 1 to verse 5?
Can I just make a comment?
Yeah, please.
I've got this New International Bible Study, and it says, "Reflect. If this love story were remade for TV, what liberty with a script might the director take to appeal to the viewers?" I can imagine all kinds of liberties.
So who would you have play Ruth in this story? I think we want to. We often want to dramatize this. We want her to be this beautiful woman, and Boaz to be this handsome man. And we want this to be a huge, larger-than-life love story. when we got into this chapter, someone said, the church I was at, I never realized the Bible was quite that racy. So let's dig in, huh? Would someone be willing to read verses 1 through 5? Someone do that? Bert, could you read for us?
Are we in 3 or are we in 4?
Chapter 3. Yeah, 1 through 5.
Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, I need to seek some security for you, so that it may be well with you. Now here is our kinsman Boaz, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." She said to her, "All that you tell me, I will do."
Getting a little warm in here. How do you react to that?
Well, in teen ministry, we call it oversharing.
Too much information.
And this translation, he read wash and perfume yourself, and this one said, wash and anoint yourself. This one says wash and perfume yourself.
Anointing, yes. Anointing was, it was a way of putting on the makeup and the perfume and all of that. It was a there's a huge truck up. What is that?
Tractor.
Tractor? Loader?
Yeah.
Hopefully don't come through the wall.
The only thing I can think of is, do I want to lie down by somebody's feet?
That's where life lies.
I think this has got, must have to do something with tradition. In Minnesota, if there's a wolf pack, to become part of the wolf pack, you wind up laying down with your stomach exposed. And accepting the fact somebody else is going to be leader and you're going to be like the servant. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if something like this isn't in that time span is what people did in these situations.
Women had another position.
They were the servants, the
slaves.
A footnote of mine says, Naomi advises this unusual expedient to her daughter-in-law for the purpose of introducing her claim.
Introducing her claim.
Okay. So she's taking out her claim there with the old Boaz dude.
Well, what do you make of this mother? What do you make of this mother-in-law giving these kind of instructions? Anyone bothered by that at all?
Well, she's looking out for security, certainly. Mm-hmm. She sees this as a way. They have to attach themselves to a man, I guess, in order to be secure in that society.
The goal is obviously security. We know that. I think it could be, it could be dangerous if we, someone, there are certain readings of the Bible that people take and they read it literally and they say, now I listen to my mother-in-law, whatever she says, I do. I'm glad Katie doesn't do that. But I think, let's kind of dig in here, verse by verse, and just holler out if there's anything you're confused about. There, in some ways, what should have happened here in this situation where someone would have died off, there was this whole idea of levirate marriage. And let's turn back to Deuteronomy, if you don't mind, just for a quick Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 25. So that. Deuteronomy 25, starting at verse 5. And it was kind of written down in Deuteronomy here as to what should happen if there's a death in the family. Everybody got that? Deuteronomy 25, 5. When brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. So again, we're in this society where it's the male character that continues the family name. It continues the family. It's the male that brings security. So it says, when the brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So the family name will continue.
Is that not done in some African tribes, John?
Yeah, normally you'd mm-hmm. marry into the family. Mm-hmm.
Right? Stay within the family.
Yeah, and yes.
No, traditionally, I don't know what they do today.
Yeah. So verse 7, but if the man has no desire to marry his brother's widow, then, oh boy, all breaks loose here, then his brother's widow shall go up to the elders at the gate and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his town shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists, saying, I have no desire to marry her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare, this is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Throughout Israel, his family shall be known as the house of him whose sandal was pulled off. Kind of interesting there. Just kind of gives the feel of what this whole family situation would have been like. Now, you think of Naomi, nothing fits here. For Naomi and Ruth, nothing fits for Naomi and Ruth. You know, both the sons are dead. You know, Elimelech is dead. So it doesn't fit the normal story. It doesn't fit what should have happened. So now, Naomi's doing a little matchmaking, and we turn back to Ruth, and kind of your finger, wherever your finger was, pull back to there. So my daughter, I need to seek some security for you because the normal ways of doing things just are not working. They're not working out for us because there's been too much pain here and too much loss. So verse 2, now here is our kinsman, Boaz, who you just happened to come across in the field, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. Does anyone know what that is? Winnowing barley? Have you ever heard that before?
Sure.
Yeah?
You throw it up in the air, let the wind blow the chaff out of it, and the grain falls down.
Yeah.
So it cleans your grain.
Yeah. Yeah, you throw it, and they do it in the evening, because that's when the breeze would come through. So they'd throw the grain up in the air, and the chaff would hopefully blow away. So they did this in the evening. So, Ruth, prepare yourself here. Now wash. Wash yourself clean. You can take 2 baths this week. And anoint yourself. Put on the perfume and the cosmetics and all. Make yourself smelling clean. And put on your best clothes. And go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. So it all fits together. It would have been after dinner time that they would have been down at the threshing room floor doing the work that they needed to do. And there would have found Boaz. And it's kind of funny. Where is it here? Well, we'll keep going here. when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, and then go and uncover his feet. So what would have happened, you would have this big floor, and everyone had their own piles of grain, and they would have done the throwing up in the air, and then they would have stayed there. They would have laid there with their grain for the night. They would have slept there. And so when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, watch from a distance, make sure you get the right guy, and then go and uncover his feet. What's that all about? Uncover his feet. Huh? Well, there's some sexual tones here about uncover his feet. Uncover his feet. There's some intimacy in those words, I think. There's some intimacy. And it doesn't say anything directly sexual in here. It isn't, you know, there isn't a reference to intercourse or anything like that. But there is some intimacy that's implied here. Uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Now that sounds very sexual there. Well, let's keep going. She said to her, "All that you tell me, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor, and she did just as her mother-in-law had instructed her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and he was, I love this line, and he was in a contented mood. He filled his belly, he was in a contented mood. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came stealthily and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there lying at his feet was a woman! Oh my gosh! He said, "Who are you?" Could you imagine the disappointment? She's planned this carefully. She's stealthily come in. And the first thing he says to her, "Who the heck are you? What are you doing?" And she replied, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." It's interesting here. This word cloak, the root word in the Hebrew is the same word that's used back in the second chapter of Ruth. And we have all these parallels. It really kind of is a testament to the artistic use of words that the author of Ruth really is using here. And so if you go back to the second chapter of Ruth, around the 12th verse, the 12th verse there, it says, "May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wing," that the root of that word is the same as the root of cloak, "under whose wing you have come for refuge." So in some ways, we have this prayer that goes out, "May the Lord protect you, give you reward, and under whose wing or under whose cloak you have come for refuge." And here we have, in verse 9 of chapter 3, a return to that language. Who are you? "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak, spread your wing, your hand of protection over your servant, for you are next of kin." He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will be for you all that you ask, for all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman." Again, you know, back in the beginning of verse 10 there, we have some, the language again is, it's, you just lose so much in the translation. But here, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter, this last instance of your loyalty." This loyalty is the word hesed. And we talked about that the other day, that this loyalty that we hear about in Ruth's song of loyalty, her commitment to be one of Naomi's people, to be that Naomi's God will be her God, is continuing here and is recognized. And it's her loyalty that gives her worth in the eyes of Boaz. And so verse 10, it talks about her loyalty now, in finding this long-term security is better than her first act of loyalty in turning from her parents, or from her homeland, and going with Naomi. So verse 11, "And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask, for all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman. But now, though it is true that I am a near kinsman, there is a nearer kinsman, more closely related than I. Remain this night and in the morning. If he will act as your next of kin for you, good, let him do it. If he is not willing to act as next of kin for you, then as the Lord lives, I will act as next of kin for you. Lie down until the morning." So we have another character coming in here. There's this kind of phantom next of kin that we don't know about that's introduced into the story. And in some ways, we're hearing about the loyalty of Boaz as well. You know, Boaz is a person of upright character. And he recognizes what he could do in this situation. That Ruth makes herself vulnerable to Boaz, but Boaz we find as one being of loyalty and character as well. And so we hear about Boaz's character here as well. So we go on. Would someone be willing to read from 14 through the end of that chapter? Somebody be willing to do that? All right.
"So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before one person could recognize another. For he said, it must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Then he said, bring the cloak you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her back. Then he went into the city. She came to her mother-in-law, who said, how did things go with you, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today.
So she laid at his feet till morning, but got up before one person could recognize her. So she stayed there. I imagine this kind of this woman creeping out. It's dark, you know. Okay, gotta sneak out before anybody else wakes up. And that Boaz says the next words, which are very interesting. It must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Boaz being one who's concerned about her name. You know, she's this foreigner from outside. She's this outsider, one that everyone else would have looked down on. But now we have Boaz, who's just, as throughout this story, just goes above and beyond in concern for her character. It must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor.
Excuse me, what was Boaz's name mean again?
Boaz's name means in him is strength.
Okay. What was that?
In him is strength. Yeah. So we have the one who we find strength in, providing or showing care for Ruth. So it goes on. Then he said, bring the cloak. Now again, we have this language of cloak. Bring that wing of protection, that thing that was prayed for, this refuge, this protection that was prayed for back at the beginning of the story. Bring that here, and let's transform that cloak you are wearing, and hold that cloak out. And so she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley, put it in her back, and then he went into the city. So this cloak, or this wing of protection, the language that's used for that, is also now used for that which holds food, that which holds what is the way that she is provided for. And so we go on. Verse 16, she came back to her mother-in-law, who said, how did things go with you? how did things go with you? I have this plan for you. Now, how did it go, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, he gave me this food. And so he said, do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Is anybody bothered at all by the mother-in-law? I know I'm pushing that angle a little bit.
Yeah, I actually have, I think the Hollywood story is the Naomi Ruth story, and their deep love and connection to each other. And that, you know, they use the customs and traditions, they have to, for their survival. But they're obviously, over and over throughout Ruth, it talks about they love each other. There's no romance that's introduced between Boaz and Ruth. There's obligation and honor. But even after she conceives, which is jumping ahead, Naomi nurses the child. So I think we miss the point if we fail to see how much connection there's between the two of those and the deep sacrifices and love between them. And that thing we read earlier, that Ruth says, I will go with you and your people will be my people. It's often read at wedding ceremonies, and not many people realize it's a pledge between two women, but it's a beautiful statement of love and connection.
I think that you really hit that on the head. I think that we often want to romanticize this story. You know, we want, and it says something probably about our culture, that we want, you know, the man and the woman riding off in the sunset, you know, together and walking on the beach together. But the love story really is that deep love, you know, between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. And I think what you said about people not knowing what that verse is about when used at weddings, you know, that's the love between a mother and a mother-in-law. If the pastor said that before they read it, between the daughter and the mother-in-law, if the pastor said that before they read it at a wedding, this is between you and your mother-in-law. You know, it might change the dynamic of the wedding.
What I'm feeling here is that what's being reflected is just a huge network of different kinds of love, of love within a larger community than a man and a woman. I'm not seeing Boaz as not being a loving person. I'm seeing him as having a much more extensive view of love than what we have today, of him being in a culture which accepts that even a remote kinsman is part of your family. I mean, I could just babble on about that, but I'm just seeing levels of love here that are just different from how we look at love today. And it reminds me from living here in Holden and being really, really aware that if one community member is really hurt or left out or not getting their needs met in some way, that everyone here feels that even if they don't particularly like that person, that when I look at these networks of tribes from back then, I'm thinking it's like that. That it really matters to you if Joe Blow over in the corner has a sad look on his face, even if he's not someone you like, he's in some way integrated into your well-being. And that having also to do with the economy of the place, that you need everyone to show up for dish tea. And it matters very much if people don't scrape their plates or if they use an extra fork because they drop one on the floor. That affects everyone in the village. So here you look at people threshing or people having their measure of grain. And it's similar to all these little things that happen here. It's similar to what us housekeepers go through. If someone puts a rotten piece of pear in the trash, or
doesn't sort out their Kleenex and Garbo,
yeah.
there's someone here who's affected by that. And that seems to me very parallel to what kinds of things, why the Bible is full of little regulations on how you go to the bathroom and what kind of clothing you wear and all that kind of thing seems real parallel to life here at Holden.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the Old Testament laws were written in the midst of community. It was, how do we live together so we don't kill each other, you know? How do we live together in love? You know, and I think, yeah, when we read the Old Testament, so often it gets a bad rap because we see all these rules and regulations, but it's about how do we live together in community?
All the little signs we have on our doors saying, here's what to do when the day you leave, bring fresh towels back, go to the laundry, sort your trash. I mean, that's just Leviticus.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's very similar to the instructions we give about how to scrape your food and where the paper trash is supposed to the landfill trash. Yeah. And whenever someone doesn't do that, it creates a ton of work here for everybody.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just see a lot of parallels there. And to me, those are all different levels of love in the sense of intimacy.
Yeah. I just finished reading a book on Desmond Tutu's theology by Michael Battle. He's a theologian from out east. And he died, you know, Desmond Tutu is just amazing. It's his language of interconnectedness, you know, that we are created to be interconnected people. And it's just, it's how we're wired. You know, I need you and you need me. You know, what hurts me hurts you, and what brings you joy brings me joy. And I see, you know, the way I embellish this story, and this will be my sin maybe, but I embellish this story in that I want to see Boaz as someone who's setting up a Holden village. He's creating an alternative society in some ways, that Ruth really isn't just one, you know, unique situation, but he's got this kind of communal farm that he's building up, and he's bringing these people in, and he's giving them a leg up. That's kind of how I embellish this story. You know, I kind of read into it that Boaz is one that goes above and beyond, and in some ways is teaching something different. Because you think, he gives Ruth the privilege of eating with his workers. Well, what does that say to the workers as well, when there's this other woman sitting there amongst them at the table? Well, that sends a real clear message to them as well about what does it mean to live as this community. And so I see him, this is my embellishment, of course, creating an alternative community there where what does affect one affects everybody else.
Well, I think that's really good, especially when you think about Galatians with Paul and Cephas, with the Jewish Christians drawing back when the people from James come. And here is this new community reborn, and yet we draw back from it because it's so strange. But if you put a Moabite woman who you're not even supposed to have any social intercourse with at all, and say she can eat with us.
Yeah. Sends a strong message. Yeah.
But what would happen to her if there wasn't that Naomi's family connection? I mean, she just—they just wouldn't look at her. She would be an outcast completely.
Yeah, there is a sense of that family connection.
But how do we know what that connection is? Does it ever mention
that? Well, it does. It's a next of kin, and so that would have meant kind of the next relative, the next closest relative. So there is some relation.
But she wouldn't have but been we don't in know. That place without that connection. She came because of Naomi.
Yeah.
She wasn't just a soul wandering nobody.
Go to Ezra and Nehemiah back there. Someone mentioned something the other day. I always find a hard time finding Ezra. There's little tiny books in the way. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job.
Ezra is after Chronicles.
Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, that song. Ezra, as you're turning to it, I'm going to find what verses I'm looking for. So I apologize. Okay, Nehemiah chapter 10. We'll start there. So Ezra and Nehemiah were written a couple hundred years after, but I think we still get a sense of what the relationships, how these relationships would have been. So in chapter 10, verse 28, there's this, does anybody have a title? You know, some of the Bibles have titles above sections.
I have agreement.
Agreement, good.
Summary of the covenant.
Yeah, that's what I have too. So there's this covenant that's
agreement
being
of the people.
Yeah, there's this covenant. And so if we, I'll just read here. The rest of the people, the priests and the Levites and the gatekeepers, the singers and the temple servants, and all who have separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to adhere to the law of God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, all who have knowledge and understanding, join with their kin, their nobles, and enter into a curse and an oath. Isn't that funny? A covenant being a curse and an oath. To walk in God's law, which was given by Moses and the servant of God, so that we don't kill each other, so we know how to live in community together, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our Lord, and his ordinances and his statutes. We will not give our daughters to peoples of the land, or take their daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring in merchandise or any grain on the Sabbath, we sell. So really what's being said here is people from other places. We won't take wives. This is kind of codifying that, you know, that we're not going to bring in people from other lands for marriage. But I guess that wasn't, I thought that was the one. If you turn back to Ezra, the book right before, I'm just trying to get kind of what this relationship would have looked like, you know, with these mixed marriages. If you go back to Ezra, the book before, chapter 9. Kind of winging it here. Chapter 9. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. Thus the holy seed has mixed itself with peoples of the lands, and in this faithlessness the officials and leaders have led the way." When I heard this, I tore my garments and my mantle and pulled hair from my head and beard and sat appalled. Then all who trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. So it's this sense that even any kind of mixed marriage was an abomination, you know? And somewhere, I couldn't find, if you go to chapter 10, I'm just trying to get this sense of what the relationship, chapter 10 of Ezra, verse 3, kind of the end of verse 2, I'll just read it here. "We have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now let us make a covenant with our God to send away all these wives and their children." So just send them away. Get rid of them. And so this would have been that attitude that even if there hadn't been, you know, any kind of specific relationship or whatnot, whatever the case may be, because this woman was not of the land, we send them away. And so there is this familial relationship in Ruth. But what would have been customary for this woman coming in without a husband, you know, she's a foreigner, she was not to be part of the community at all. There we go. So I think that was the bow. Kind of a gloomy spot to end. Sorry. We'll keep going. There's hope coming, though.
There are so many questions.
Yeah, there are. There are. I think that's what's fun about this story, is it's a story we can get through in a week. You know, we can hear the story from beginning to end, for those that are here all week. But we can get from beginning to end. But it really is this story of God working behind the scenes. You know, God working through people. A God of love. A God who promises to always be present. Even in the lives of an outsider like Ruth. You know, I think that has lots of applicability to a community like this, like you were saying, you know, where there's constantly insiders and outsiders. And what does Scripture say to us? What does this story speak to us about God's presence in the midst of all that? God is one that draws people together, insiders and outsiders. And it's a beautiful story. So thank you for journeying today.
Thank you, Katie. Oh, just a scarf. Promise.